darkness, to the projectionist's booth, she assumed. Audrey went to the door marked manager, grasped the knob, and leaned her brow against the wood. Outside, the wind moaned like a dying thing. "David?" she asked gently. She paused, listened. "David, do you hear me? It's Audrey, David. Audrey Weiler. I want to help you." No answer. She opened the door and saw an empty room with an ancient poster for Bonnie and Clyde on the wall and a torn mattress on the floor. In the same magic marker, someone had written, "I'm a midnight creeper, all day sleeper," below the poster. She tried the janitor's cubby next. It wasn't much bigger than a closet and completely empty. The unmarked door gave on a room that had probably once been a supply closet. Her nose, keener now, like her eyesight, picked up the aroma of long-ago popcorn. There were a lot of dead flies and a fair scattering of mouse shit, but nothing else. She went to the archway, swept aside the dangling dolly with her forearm, and peered out. She couldn't see the stage from back here, just the top half of the screen. The skinny girl was still yelling for David, but the others were silent. That might not mean anything, but she didn't like not knowing where they were. Audrey decided that the sign around the dolly's neck was probably a true warning. The seats had been taken out, making it easy to see the way the balcony floor heaved and twisted. It made her think of a poem she'd read in college, something about a painted ship on a painted ocean. If the brat wasn't out on the balcony, he was somewhere else, somewhere close. He couldn't have gone far. And he wasn't on the balcony, that much was for sure. With the seats gone, there was nowhere to hide, not so much as a drape or a velvet swag on the wall. Audrey dropped the arm which had been holding the half-deflated doll aside. It swung back and forth, the noose around its neck making a slow rubbing sound. Its blank eyes stared at Audrey. Its hole of a mouth with only one purpose, seemed to leer at her, to laugh at her. "Look at what you're doing," Frida Fuck Dolly seemed to be saying. "You were going to become the most highly paid woman geologist in the country, own your own consulting firm by the time you were 35, maybe win the Nobel Prize by the time you were 50. Weren't those the dreams? The Devonian-era scholar, the summa cum laude whose paper on tectonic plates was published in Geology Review, is chasing after little boys in crumbling old movie theaters. And no ordinary little boy, either. He's special, the way you always assumed you were special. And if you do find him, Aud, what then? He's strong." She grabbed the hangman's noose and yanked hard, snapping the old rope and pulling out a pretty country fair bunch of Arnell hair at the same time. The doll landed face down at Audrey's feet, and she drop-kicked it onto the balcony. It floated high, then settled. "Not stronger than tack," she thought. "I don't care what he is, he's not stronger than tack. Not stronger than the Cantaz, either. It's our town now. Never mind the past and the dreams of the past. This is the present, and it's sweet. Sweet to kill, to take, to own. Sweet to rule, even in the desert. The boy is just a boy. The others are only food. Tack is here now, and he speaks with the voice of the older age, with the voice of the unformed." She looked up the hall toward the stairs. She nodded, her right hand slipping into the pocket of her dress to touch the things that were there, to fondle them against her thigh. He was in the projection booth. There was a big padlock hanging on the door which led into the basement, so where else could he be? "Him in tow," she whispered, starting forward. Her eyes were wide, the fingers of her right hand moving ceaselessly in the pocket of her dress. From beneath them came small, stony clicking sounds. 3. The kids who partied hardy upstairs in the American West until the fire escape fell down had been slobs, but they had mostly used the hall and the manager's office for their revels. The other rooms were relatively untouched, and the projectionist's little suite, the booth, the office cubicle, the closet-sized toilet stall, was almost exactly as it had been on the day in 1979 when five cigarette-smoking men from Nevada Sunlight Entertainment had come in, dismantled the carbon filament projectors, and taken them to Reno, where they still languished in a warehouse filled with similar equipment, like fallen idols. David was on his knees, head down, eyes closed, hands pressed together in front of his chin. The dusty linoleum beneath him was lighter than that which surrounded him. Straight ahead was a second lighter rectangle. It was here that the old projectors, clattery, baking-hot dinosaurs that raised the temperature in this room as high as 120 degrees on some summer nights, had stood. To his left were the cutouts through which they had shown their swords of light and projected their larger-than-life shadows. Gregory Peck and Kirk Douglas, Sophia Loren and Jane Mansfield, a young Paul Newman hustling pool, an old but still vital Betty Davis torturing her wheelchair-bound sister. Dusty coils of film lay here and there on the floor like dead snakes. There were old stills and posters on the walls. One of the latter showed Marilyn Monroe standing on a subway grating and trying to hold down her flaring skirt. Beneath a hand-drawn arrow pointing at her panties, some wit had printed, "Carefully insert shaft A in slot B, making sure tool is seated firmly and cannot slip out." There was an odd decayed smell in here, not quite mildew, not quite dry rot either. It smelled curdled, like something that had gone spectacularly bad before finally drying up. David didn't notice the smell any more than he heard Audrey softly calling his name from the hall which ran past the balcony. He had come here when the others had run to Billingsley. Even Audrey had gone as far as stage left at first, perhaps to make sure they were all going down the hall. Because he had been nearly overwhelmed by a need to pray, he had an idea that this time it would just be a matter of getting to someplace quiet and opening the door. This time, God wanted to talk to him, not the other way around. And this was a good place to do it. Pray in your closet and not in the street, the Bible said, and David thought that was excellent advice. Now that he had a closed door between him and the rest of them, he could open the one inside him. He wasn't afraid of being observed by spiders or snakes or rats. If God wanted this to be a private meeting, it would be a private meeting. The woman Steve and Cynthia had found was the real problem. She for some reason made him nervous, and he had a feeling she felt the same about him. He had wanted to get away from her, so he had slipped over the edge of the stage and run up the center aisle. He was under the sagging balcony and into the lobby before Audrey turned back from the stage left side of the movie screen, looking for him. From the lobby, he had come up to the second floor, and then had simply let some interior compass, or maybe it was Reverend Martin's still, small voice, lead him up here. He had walked across the room, barely seeing the old curls of film and the remaining posters, barely smelling the odor which might or might not have been celluloid fantasies stewed by the desert sun until they fell apart. He had stopped on this patch of linoleum, considering for a moment the large holes at the corners of the lighter rectangle shapes, holes where the king bolts which held the projector firmly in place had once gone. They reminded him, "I see holes like eyes," of something, something which fluttered briefly in his mind and then was gone. False memory, real memory, intuition, all of the above, none of the above. He hadn't known, hadn't really cared. His priority then had been to get in touch with God, if he could. He had never needed to more than now. "Yes," Reverend Martin said calmly inside his head. "And this is where your work is supposed to pay off. You keep in touch with God when the cupboard's full, so you can reach out to him when it's empty. How many times did I tell you that last winter and this spring? A lot. He just hoped that Martin, who drank more than he should and maybe couldn't be entirely trusted, had been telling the truth instead of just mouthing what David's dad called the company line. He hoped that with all his mind and heart, because there were other gods in desperation. He was sure of it. He began his prayer as he always did, not aloud but in his mind, sending words out in clear, even pulses of thought. See in me, God, be in me, and speak in me if you mean to, if it's your will. As always at these times when he felt really in need of God, the front of his mind was serene, but the deeper part, where faith did constant battle with doubt, was terrified that there would be no answer. The problem was simple enough. Even now, after all his reading and praying and instruction, even after what had happened to his friend, he doubted God's existence. Had God used him, David Carver, to save Brian Ross's life? Why would God do a wild and crazy thing like that? Wasn't it more likely that what Dr. Wasluski had called a clinical miracle and what David himself had thought of as an answered prayer had actually been nothing more than a clinical coincidence? People could make shadows that looked like animals, but they were still only shadows, minor tricks of light and projection. Wasn't it likely that God was the same kind of thing, just another legendary shadow? David closed his eyes tighter, concentrating on the mantra and trying to clear his mind. See in me, be in me, speak in me if it's your will. And a kind of darkness came down. It was like nothing he had ever known or experienced before. He sagged sideways against the wall between two of the projection cutouts, eyes rolling up to whites, hands falling into his lap. A low, guttural sound came from his throat. It was followed by sleep talk, which perhaps only David's mother could have understood. Shit, he muttered. The mummy's after us. Then he fell silent, leaning against the wall, a silver runner of drool, almost as fine as a spider's thread, slipping from one corner of what was, essentially, still a child's mouth. Outside the door, which he had shut in order to be alone with his God, there had once been a bolt on it, but that was long gone. Approaching footsteps could now be heard. They stopped outside the door. There was a long, listening pause, and then the knob turned. The door opened. Audrey Weiler stood there. Her eyes widened when they happened on the unconscious boy. She came into the fuggy little room, closed the door behind her, and looked for something, anything, to tilt and prop under the knob. A board, a chair. It wouldn't hold them off for long if they came up here, but even a thin margin might mean the difference between success and failure at this stage. But there was nothing. Fuck, she whispered. She looked at the boy, realizing without much surprise that she was afraid of him, afraid even to go near him. Tak-a-wan, the voice in her head. Tak-a-wan, this time out of her mouth. Assent, both helpless and heartfelt. She went down the two steps into the projection booth proper and crossed, wincing at each gritting step, to where David leaned on his knees against the wall with the cutouts in it. She kept expecting his eyes to fly open, eyes that would be filled with an electric blue power. The right hand in her pocket squeezed the cantas together once more, drawing strength, then, reluctantly, left them. She dropped to her own knees in front of David, her cold and shaking fingers clasped before her. How ugly he was! And the smell coming from him was even more offensive to her. Of course she had stayed away from him. He looked like a gorgon and stank like a stew of spoiled meat and sour milk. "Pray, boy," she said. Ugly little pray boy. Her voice had changed into something that was neither male nor female. Black shapes had begun to move vaguely beneath the skin of her cheeks and forehead, like the beating, membranous wings of small insects. "Here's what I should have done the first time I saw your toad's face." Audrey's hands, strong and tanned, chipped here and there with scabs from her work, settled around David Carver's throat. His eyelids fluttered when those hands shut off his windpipe and stopped his breath. But just once. Just once. 4. "Why'd you stop?" Steve asked. He stood in the center of the improbable onstage living room beside the elegant old wet bar from the Circle Ranch. His strongest wish at that moment was for a fresh shirt. All day he had been baking. To call the Ryder van's air conditioning substandard was actually to be charitable. But now he was freezing. The water Cynthia was dabbing onto the punctures in his shoulders ran down his back in chill streams. At least he'd been able to talk her out of using Billingsley's whiskey to clean his wounds, like a dance hall girl fixing up a cowpoke in an old movie. "I thought I saw something," Cynthia spoke in a low voice. "What did I put it at?" "Very funny." She raised her voice to a shout. "David? David!" They were alone on stage. Steve had wanted to help Marinville and Carver look for the kid, but Cynthia had insisted on washing out what she called the holes in your hide first. The two men had disappeared into the lobby. Marinville had a new spring in his step, and the way he carried his gun made Steve think of another kind of old movie, the kind where the grizzled but heroic white hunter slogs through 1,000 jungle perils and finally succeeds in plucking an emerald as big as a doorknob from the forehead of an idol watching over a lost city. "What? What did you see?" "I don't really know. It was weird, up on the balcony. For a minute I thought it was, you'll laugh, a floating body." Suddenly, something in him changed. It wasn't like a light going on. It was more as if one had been turned out. He forgot about the stinging of the wounds in his shoulders, but all at once his back was colder than ever, almost cold enough to start him shivering. For the second time that day, he remembered being a teenager in Lubbock, and how the whole world seemed to go still and deadly before the benders arrived from the plains, dragging their sometimes deadly skirts of hail and wind. "I'm not laughing," he said. "Let's go on up there." "It was probably just a shadow." "I don't think so." "Steve? You okay?" "No, I feel like I did when we came into town." She looked at him, alarmed. "Okay, but we don't have a gun." "Fuck that." He grabbed her arm. His eyes were wide, his mouth pinched. "Now, Christ, something is really wrong. Can't you feel it?"
"I might feel something. Should I get Mary? She's back with Billingsley."
"No time. Come or stay here. Suit yourself."
He shrugged up the sides of the coverall, jumped off the stage, stumbled, grabbed a seat in the front row to steady himself, then ran up the center aisle. When he got to its head, Cynthia was right behind him, once again not even out of breath. The chick could motor. You had to give her that. The boss was just coming out of the box office, Ralph Carver behind him. "We've been looking out at the street," Johnny said. "The storm is definitely..."
"Steve? What's wrong?"
Without answering, Steve looked around, spotted the stairs, and pelted up them. Part of him was still amazed at the speed with which this feeling of urgency had grabbed hold. Most of him was just scared.
"David! David, answer if you can hear me."
Nothing. A grim, trash-lined hallway leading past what were probably the old balcony and a snack bar alcove. Narrow stairs going farther up at the far end. No one here. Yet he had a clear sense that there had been, and only a short time ago.
"David," he shouted.
"Steve? Mr. Ames?" It was Carver. He sounded almost as scared as Steve felt. "What's wrong? Has something happened to my son?"
"I don't know."
Cynthia ducked under Steve's arm and hurried down the hallway to the balcony entrance. Steve went after her. A frayed length of rope was hanging down from the top of the arch, still swaying a little.
"Look,"
Cynthia pointed. At first, Steve thought the thing lying out there was a corpse, then registered the hair for what it was, some kind of synthetic. A doll, one with a noose around its neck.
"Is this what you saw?" he asked her.
"Yes. Someone could have ripped it down and then maybe drop-kicked it." The face she turned up to his was drawn and tense. In a voice almost too low to hear, she whispered, "God, Steve, I don't like this." Steve took a step back, glanced left. The boss and David's father looked at him anxiously, clutching their weapons against their chests, then looked right.
"There," his heart whispered,
or perhaps it was his nose, picking up some lingering residue of opium, that whispered.
"Up there must be the projection booth."
He ran for it, Cynthia once more on his heels. He went up the narrow flight of stairs and was groping for the knob in the dimness when she grabbed the back of his pants to hold him where he was. "The kid had a pistol. If she's in there with him, she could have it now. Be careful, Steve."
"David," Carver bawled. "David, are you okay?"
Steve thought of telling Cynthia there was no time to be careful, that that time had passed when they lost track of David in the first place. But there was no time to talk, either. He turned the knob and shoved the door hard with his shoulder, expecting to encounter either a lock or some other resistance, but there was none. The door flew open. He flew into the room after it. Across from him, against the wall with the projection slots cut into it, were David and Audrey. David's eyes were half open, but only their bulging whites showed. His face was a horrible corpse color, still greenish from the soap, but mostly gray. There were growing lavender patches beneath his eyes and high up on his cheekbones. His hands drummed spastically on the thighs of his jeans. He was making a soft choking sound. Audrey's right hand was clamped around his throat, her thumb buried deep in the soft flesh beneath his jaw on the right, the fingers digging in on the left. Her formerly pretty face was contorted in an expression of hate and rage beyond anything Steve had ever seen in his life. It seemed to have actually darkened her skin somehow. In her left hand, she held the .45 revolver David had used to shoot the coyote. She fired it 3 times, and then it clicked empty. The 2-step drop into the projection booth almost certainly saved Steve at least one more hole in his already perforated hide, and might have saved his life. He fell forward like a man who has misjudged the number of stairs in a flight, and all 3 bullets went over his head. One thudded into the door jamb to Cynthia's right and showered splinters into her exotic hair. Audrey voiced a ululating scream of frustration. She threw the empty gun at Steve, who simultaneously ducked and raised one hand to bat it away. Then she turned back to the slumping boy and began to throttle him with both hands again, shaking him viciously back and forth like a doll. David's hands abruptly quit thrumming and simply lay on the legs of his jeans, as limp as dead starfish.
5. "Scared,"
Billingsley croaked. It was, so far as Mary could tell, the last word he ever managed to say. His eyes looked up at her, both frantic and somehow confused. He tried to say something else and produced only a weak, gargling noise. "Don't be scared, Tom. I'm right here."
"Ah! Ah!"
His eyes shifted from side to side, then came back to her face and seemed to freeze there. He took a deep breath, let it out, took a shallower one, let it out, and didn't take another. "Tom?" Nothing but a gust of wind and a hard rattle of sand from outside.
"Tom!"
She shook him. His head rolled limply from side to side, but his eyes remained fixed on hers in a way that gave her a chill. It was the way the eyes in some painted portrait seemed to stay on you, no matter where you were in the room. Somewhere, in this building, but sounding very far away, just the same, she could hear Marinville's roadie yelling for David. The hippie girl was yelling, too. Mary supposed she should join them, help them search for David and Audrey if they were really lost, but she was reluctant to leave Tom until she was positive he was dead. She was pretty sure he was, yes, but it surely wasn't like on TV when you knew. Help? The voice, questioning and almost too weak to be heard over the slackening wind, still made Mary jump and cup a hand over her mouth to stifle a cry. Help? Is anyone there? Please help me. I'm hurt. A woman's voice. Ellen Carver's voice? Christ, was it? Although she had been in the company of David's mother for only a short time, Mary was sure she was right almost as soon as the idea occurred to her. She got to her feet, sparing another quick glance at poor Tom Billingsley's contorted face and staring eyes. Her legs had stiffened up on her, and she staggered for balance. Please... The voice outside moaned. It was in the alley which ran behind the theater. Ellen? She asked, suddenly wishing she could throw her voice like a ventriloquist. It seemed she could trust nothing now, not even a hurt, scared woman. Ellen, is that you? Mary! Closer now. Yes, it's me, Ellen. Is that Mary? Mary opened her mouth, then closed it again. That was Ellen Carver out there. She knew it, but... Is David all right? The woman out there in the dark asked, then swallowed back a sob. Please say that he is. So far as I know, yes. Mary walked over to the broken window, skirting the pool of the cougar's blood, and looked out. It was Ellen Carver out there, and she didn't look good. She was slumped over her left arm, which she was holding against her breasts with her right. What Mary could see of her face was chalky white. Blood was trickling from her lower lip and from one nostril. She looked up at Mary with eyes so dark and desperate they seemed hardly human. "How did you get away from Entragian?" Mary asked. "I didn't. He just died. Bled everywhere and died. He was driving me in his car, taking me up to the mine, I think, when it happened. The car went off the road and turned over. One of the back doors popped open. Lucky for me, or I'd still be inside, caught like a bug in a can. I walked back to town." "What happened to your arm?" "It's broken," Ellen said, hunching over it further. There was something unattractive about the pose. Ellen Carver looked like a troll in a fairy story, hunched protectively over a bag of ill-gotten gold. "Can you help me get in? I want to see my husband, and I want to see David." A part of Mary cried out in alarm at the idea, told her that something here did not compute. But when Ellen held up her good arm, and Mary saw the dirt and blood smeared on it, and the way it was trembling with exhaustion, her fundamentally kind heart overruled the wary lizard of instinct living far back in her brain. This woman had lost her young daughter to a madman, had been in a car wreck on the way to what would have most likely been her own murder, had suffered a broken arm, and walked through a howling windstorm back to a town filled mostly with corpses. And the first person she meets suddenly succumbs to a bad case of the Jim Jams and refuses to let her in? Uh-uh, Mary thought. No way. And, perhaps absurdly, that's not how I was raised. "You can't come in this window. There's a lot of broken glass. Something, an animal, jumped through it. Go a little further along the back of the theater. You'll come to the ladies' room. That's better. There are even some boxes to stand on. I'll help you in, okay?" "Yes. Thank you, Mary. Thank God I found you." Ellen gave her a horrible, grimacing smile. Gratitude, shoe-licking humility, and what might have been terror all mixed together, and then shuffled on, head down, back bent. 12 hours ago, she had been Mrs. Suburban Wife Mom, on her way to a nice middle-class vacation in Lake Tahoe, where she had probably planned to wear her new resort clothes from Talbot's over her new underwear from Victoria's Secret. Daytime sun with the kids, nighttime sex with the comfy known partner, postcards home to the friends, having a great time, the air is so clean, wish you were here. Now she looked and acted like a refugee, a no-age war hag fleeing some ugly desert bloodbath. And Mary Jackson, that sweet little princess, votes Democratic, gives blood every 2 months, writes poetry, had actually considered leaving her out there to moan in the dark until she could consult with the men. And what did that mean? That she had been in the same war, Mary supposed. This was how you thought, how you behaved, when it happened to you. Except she wouldn't. Be damned if she would. Mary crossed the hall, listening for any further shouts from the theater. There were none. Then, just as she pushed open the ladies' room door, 3 gunshots rang out. They were muffled by walls and distance, but there was no doubt about what they were. Shouts followed them. Mary froze in place, pulled in 2 different directions with equal force. What decided her was the soft sound of weeping from beyond the unlatched ladies' room window. "Ellen, what is it? What's wrong?" "I'm stupid, that's all. Stupid. I bumped my bad arm putting up another crate to stand on." The woman outside the window, she was just a blur of shadow on the frosted glass, began sobbing harder. "Hold on, you'll be inside in a jiffy," Mary said, and hurried across the room. She set aside the beer bottles Billingsley had put up on the window ledge and was lifting the hinged window, trying to think how best to help Ellen into the room without hurting her further, when she remembered what Billingsley had said about the cop, that he was taller. "Dear God," David's father had said, a look of thunderstruck understanding on his face. "She's like Entragian? Like the cop?" "Maybe she's got a broken arm," Mary thought coldly. "Maybe she really does. On the other hand, hunching over like that was actually a very good way to disguise one's true height, wasn't it?" The lizard which usually kept its place on the back wall of her brain suddenly leaped forward, chirping in terror. Mary decided to pull back, take a moment or two and think things over. But before she could, her arm was seized by a strong, hot hand. Another one banged open the window, and all of Mary's strength ran out of her like water as she looked into the grinning face staring up at her. It was Ellen's face, but the badge pinned below it. "I see you're an organ donor. Belong to Entragian." It was Entragian. Collie Entragian somehow living in Ellen Carver's body. "No!" she screamed, yanking backward, heedless of the pain as Ellen's fingernails punched into her arms and brought blood. "No! Let go of me!" "Not until I hear you sing Leaving on a Jet Plane, you cunt," the Ellen thing said, and as it yanked Mary forward through the window it was still holding open, blood burst from both of Ellen's nostrils in a gush. More blood trickled from Ellen's left eye like gummy tears. "Oh, the dawn is breaking, it's early morn." Mary had a confused sensation of flying toward the board fence on the other side of the lane. "The taxi driver is blowing his horn." She managed to get one blocking arm up, but not enough. She took most of the impact with her forehead and went to her knees, head ringing. She could feel warmth spreading over her lips and chin. "Join the nosebleed club, babe," she thought, and staggered to her feet. "Already I'm so lonesome I could cry." Mary took 2 large, lunging strides, and then the cop, She couldn't stop thinking of it as the cop, only now wearing a wig and falsies, grabbed her by the shoulder, almost tearing one arm off her shirt as it whirled Mary around. "Let go!" Mary began, and then the Ellen thing clipped her on the point of the chin, a crisp and elementary blow that put out the lights. It caught Mary under the arms on her way down and pulled her close. When it felt Mary's breath on Ellen's skin, the faint anxiety which had been on Ellen's face cleared. "Gosh, I love that song," it said, and slung Mary over her shoulder like a sack of grain. "It turns me all gushy inside. Tack!" She disappeared around the corner with her burden. 5 minutes later, Collie and Trajan's dusty caprice was once more on its way out to the China pit, headlights cutting through the swirls of sand driven by the dying wind. As it drove past Harvey's small engine repair and the bodega beyond it, a thin blue-white sickle of moon appeared in the sky overhead. Chapter 5. 1. Even in the boozy, druggy days, Johnny Merrinville's recall had been pretty relentless. In 1986, while riding in the back of Sean Hutter's so-called party-mobile, Sean had been doing the Friday night East Hampton rounds with Johnny and three others in the big old 65 caddy, he had been involved in a fatal accident. Sean, who had been too drunk to walk, let alone drive, had rolled the party-mobile over twice, trying to make the turn from Eggamoggin Lane onto Route B without slowing down. The girl sitting next to Hutter had been killed. Sean's spine had been pulverized. The only party-mobile he ran these days was a motorized cadding wheelchair, the kind you steered with your chin. The others had suffered minor injuries. Johnny had considered himself lucky to get off with a bruised spleen and a broken foot. But the thing was, he was the only one who remembered what had happened. Johnny found this so curious that he had questioned the survivors carefully, even Sean, who kept crying and telling him to go away. Johnny hadn't obliged until he'd gotten what he wanted. What the hell, he figured. Sean owed him. Patty Nickerson said she had a vague memory of Sean saying, "Hold on, we're going for a ride," just before it happened, but that was it. With the others, recall simply stopped short of the accident and then picked up again at some point after it, as if their memories had been squirted with some amnesia-producing ink. Sean himself claimed to remember nothing after getting out of the shower that afternoon and wiping the steam off the mirror so he could see to shave. After that, he said, everything was black until he'd awakened in the hospital. He might have been lying about that, but Johnny didn't think so. Yet he himself remembered everything. Sean hadn't said, "Hold on, we're going for a ride." He had said, "Hang on, we're going wide," and laughing as he said it. He went on laughing even when the party-mobile had started to roll. Johnny remembered Patty screaming, "My hair! Oh, shit, my hair!" and how she had landed on his crotch with a ball-numbing thud when the car went over. He remembered Bruno Gartner bellowing, and the sound of the party-mobile's collapsing roof driving Rachel Timurov's head down into her neck, splitting her skull open like a bone flower. A tight crunching sound it had been, the sound you hear in your head when you smash an ice cube between your teeth. He remembered shit. He knew that was part of being a writer, but he didn't know if it was nature or nurture, cause or effect. He supposed it didn't matter. The thing was, he remembered shit even when it was as confusing as the final 30 seconds of a big fireworks display. Stuff that overlapped seemed to automatically separate and fall into line even as it was happening, like iron filings lining up under the pull of a magnet. Until the night Sean Hutter had rolled his party-mobile, Johnny had never wished for anything different. He had never wished for anything different since. Until now. Right now, a little ink squirted into the old memory cells might be just fine. He saw splinters jump from the jamb of the projection booth door and land in Cynthia's hair when Audrey fired the pistol. He felt one of the slugs drone past his right ear. He saw Steve, down on one knee but apparently okay, bat away the revolver when the woman hucked it at him. She lifted her upper lip, snarled at Steve like a cornered dog, then turned back and clamped her hands around the kid's throat again. "Go on," Johnny shouted at himself. "Go on and help him, like you did before when you shot the cat." But he couldn't. He could see everything, but he couldn't move. Things began to overlap then, but his mind insisted on sequencing them, neatening them, giving them a coherent shape, like a narrative. He saw Steve leap at Audrey, telling her to quit it, to let the boy go, cupping her neck with one hand and grabbing her wrists with the other. At this same moment, Johnny was slammed past the skinny girl and into the room with the force of a stuntman shot from a cannon. It was Ralph, of course, hitting him from behind and bawling his son's name at the top of his lungs. Johnny flew out over the two-step drop, knees bent, convinced he was going to sustain multiple fractures at the very least, convinced that the boy was dying or already dead, convinced that Audrey Weiler's mind had snapped under the strain and she had fallen under the delusion that David Carver was either the cop or a minion of the cop. And all the time, his eyes went on recording, and his brain kept on receiving the images and storing them. He saw the way Audrey's muscular legs were spread, the material of her skirt strained taut between them. He also saw he was going to touch down near her. He landed on one foot, like a skater who has forgotten his skates. His knee buckled. He let it, throwing himself forward into the woman, grabbing her hair. She pulled her head back and snapped at his fingers. At the same instant, except Johnny's mind insisted it was the next instant, even now wanting to reduce this madness to something coherent, a narrative which would flow and train, Steve tore her hands away from the kid's throat. Johnny saw the white marks of her palms and fingers there, and then his momentum was carrying him by. She missed biting him, which was the good news, but he missed his grip on her hair, which was the bad. She voiced a guttural cry as he collided with the wall. His left arm shot out through one of the projection slots up to the shoulder, and for one awful moment he was sure that the rest of him was going to follow it. Out, down, goodbye. It was impossible. The hole was nowhere near big enough for that, but he thought it anyway. At this same moment, his mind once more insisting it was the next moment, the next thing, the new sentence, Ralph Carver yelled, "Get your hands off my boy, bitch!" Johnny retrieved his arm and turned around, putting his back to the wall. He saw Steve and Ralph drag the screaming woman off David. He saw the boy collapse against the wall and slide slowly down it, the marks on his throat standing out brutally. He saw Cynthia come down the steps and into the room, trying to look everywhere at once. "Grab the kid, boss," Steve panted. He was struggling with Audrey, one hand still clamped on her wrists and the other now around her waist. She bucked under him like a canyon mustang. "Grab him and get him out of here." Audrey screamed and pulled free. When Ralph made a clumsy attempt to get his arms around her neck and put her in a headlock, she shoved the heel of one hand under his chin and pushed him back. She retreated a step, saw David, and snarled again, her lips drawing away from her teeth. She made a move to go in his direction, and Ralph said, "Touch him again and I'll kill you. Promise." "Ah, fuck this," Johnny thought, and snatched the boy up. He was warm and limp and heavy in his arms. Johnny's back, already outraged by nearly a continent's worth of motorcycling, gave a warning twinge. Audrey glanced at Ralph, as if daring him to try and make good on his promise, then tensed to leap at Johnny. Before she could, Steve was on her once more. He grabbed her around the waist again, then pivoted on his heels, the two of them face to face. She was uttering a long and continuous caterwauling that made Johnny's feelings ache. Halfway through his second spin, Steve let her go. Audrey flew backward like a stone cast out of a sling, her feet stuttering on the floor, still caterwauling. Cynthia, who was behind her, dropped to her hands and knees with the speed of a born playground survivor. Audrey collided with her shin high and went over backward, sprawling on the lighter-colored rectangle where the second projector had rested. She stared up at them through the tumble of her hair, momentarily dazed.
"Get him out of here, boss!"
Steve waved his hands at the steps leading up to the projection booth door. "There's something wrong with her. She's like the animals."
"What do you mean, like them?" Johnny thought. "She fucking well is one."
He heard what Steve was telling him, but he didn't start toward the door. Once again, he seemed incapable of movement. Audrey scrambled to her feet, sliding up the corner of the room. Her upper lip was still rising and falling in a jagged snarl, eyes moving from Johnny and the unconscious boy cradled in his arms to Ralph, and then to Cynthia, who had now also gotten to her feet and was pressing against Steve's side. Johnny thought briefly and longingly of the Rossi shotgun and the Ruger 44. Both were in the lobby, leaning against the ticket booth. The booth had offered a good view of the street, but it had been easier to leave the guns outside it, given the limited space, and neither he nor Ralph had thought to bring them up here. He now believed that one of the scariest lessons this nightmare had to offer was how lethally unprepared for survival they all were. Yet they had survived. Most of them, anyway. So far.
Tak Allah!
The woman spoke in a voice that was both frightening and powerful, nothing like her earlier one, her storytelling voice. That one had been low and often hesitant. To Johnny, this one seemed only a step or two above a dog's bark. And was she laughing? He thought that at least part of her was. And what of that strange swimming darkness just below the surface of her skin? Was he really seeing that?
Min! Min! Min in tow!
Cynthia cast a bewildered glance at Steve.
What's she saying?
Steve shook his head. She looked at Johnny.
It's the cops' language, he said.
He cast his peculiarly efficient recollection back to the moment when the cop had apparently sicked a buzzard on him.
"Timon!" he snapped at Audrey Weiler. "Candy latch!"
That wasn't quite right, but it must have at least been close. Audrey recoiled, and for a moment there was a very human look of surprise on her face. Then the lip lifted again, and the lunatic smile reappeared in her eyes.
"What did you say to her?"
Cynthia asked Johnny.
"I have no idea. Boss, you gotta get the kid out. Now."
Johnny took a step backward, meaning to do just that. Audrey reached into the pocket of her dress, as he did, and brought it out, curled around a fistful of something. She stared at him, only at him now, John Edward Merinville, distinguished novelist and extraordinary thinker, with her snarling beast's eyes. She held her hand out, wrist up.
"Can-ta!"
she cried.
Laughed. "Can-ta! Can-tack! What you take is what you are, of course! Can-ta! Can-tack! Me-tow! Take this! So-ta!"
When she opened her hand and showed him her offering, the emotional weather inside his head changed at once. And yet he still saw everything and sequenced it, just as he had when Sean Hutter's goddamn partymobile had rolled over. He had kept on recording everything then, when he had been sure he was going to die, and he went on recording everything now, when he was suddenly consumed with hate for the boy in his arms, and overwhelmed by a desire to put something, his motorcycle key would do nicely, into the interfering little prey boy's throat and open him like a can of beer. He thought at first that there were three odd-looking charms lying on her open palm, the sort of thing girls sometimes wore dangling from their bracelets. But they were too big, too heavy. Not charms, but carvings, stone carvings, each about 2 inches long. One was a snake. The second was a buzzard with one wing chipped off. Mad, bulging eyes stared out at him from beneath its bald dome. The third was a rat on its hind legs. They all looked pitted and ancient.
"Can-ta!" she screamed. "Can-ta! Can-tack! Kill the boy! Kill him now! Kill him!"
Steve stepped forward. With her attention and concentration fully fixed on Johnny, she saw him only at the last instant. He slapped the stones from her hand, and they flew into the corner of the room. One, it was the snake, broke in two. Audrey screamed with horror and vexation. The murderous fury which had come over Johnny's mind dissipated but didn't depart completely. He could feel his eyes wanting to turn toward the corner where the carvings lay, waiting for him. All he had to do was pick them up.
"Get him the fuck out of here!" Steve yelled.
Audrey lunged for the carvings. Steve seized her arm and yanked her back. Her skin was darkening and sagging. Johnny thought that the process which had changed her was now trying to reverse itself, without much success. She was, what? Shrinking? Diminishing? He didn't know the right word, but...
"Get him out!"
Steve yelled again and smacked Johnny on the shoulder. That woke him up. He began to turn, and then Ralph was there. He had snatched David from Johnny's arms almost before Johnny knew it was happening. Ralph bounded up the stairs, clumsy but powerful, and was gone from the projection booth without a single look back. Audrey saw him go. She howled. It was despair Johnny heard in that howl now, and lunged for the stones again. Steve yanked her back. There was a peculiar ripping sound as Audrey's right arm pulled off at the shoulder. Steve was left holding it in his hand, like the drumstick of an overcooked chicken. 2. Audrey seemed unaware of what had happened to her. One-armed, the right side of her dress now darkening with blood, she made for the carvings, gibbering in that strange language. Steve was frozen in place, looking at what he held, a lightly freckled human arm with a Casio watch on the wrist. The boss was equally frozen. If it hadn't been for Cynthia, Steve later thought, Audrey would have gotten to the carvings again. God knew what would have happened if she had. Even when she had been obviously focusing the power of the stones on the boss, Steve had felt the backwash. There had been nothing sexual about it this time. This time, it had been about murder and nothing else. Before Audrey could fall on her knees in the corner and grab her toys, Cynthia kicked them deftly away, sending them skittering along the wall with the cutouts in it. Audrey howled again, and this time a spray of blood came out of her mouth along with the sound. She turned her head to them, and Steve staggered backward, actually raising a hand as if to block the sight of her from his vision. Audrey's formerly pretty face now drooped from the front of her skull in sweating wrinkles. Her staring eyeballs hung from widening sockets. Her skin was blackening and splitting. Yet none of this was the worst. The worst came as Steve dropped the hideously warm thing he was holding, and she lurched to her feet. "I'm very sorry," she said. And in her choked and failing voice, Steve heard a real woman, not this decaying monstrosity. "I never meant to hurt anyone. Don't touch the cantas. Whatever else you do, don't touch the cantas." Steve looked at Cynthia. She stared back, and he could read her mind in her wide eyes. "I touched one. Twice. How lucky was I?" "Very," Steve thought. "I think you were very lucky. I think we both were." Audrey staggered toward them and away from the pitted gray stones. Steve could smell a rich odor of blood and decay. He reached out but couldn't bring himself to actually put a restraining hand on her shoulder, even though she was headed for the stairs in the hallway, headed in the direction Ralph had taken his boy. He couldn't bring himself to do it because he knew his fingers would sink in. Now he could hear a plopping, pattering sound as parts of her began to liquefy and fall off in a kind of flesh rain. She mounted the steps and lurched out through the door. Cynthia looked up at Steve for a moment, her face pinched and white. He put his arm around her waist and followed Johnny up the stairs. Audrey made it about halfway down the short but steep flight of stairs leading to the second floor hall, then fell. The sound of her inside her blood-soaked dress was grisly, a splashing sound almost. Yet she was still alive. She began to crawl, her hair hanging in strings, mercifully obscuring most of her dangling face. At the far end, by the stairs leading down to the lobby, Ralph stood with David in his arms, staring at the oncoming creature.
"Shoot her!" Johnny roared. "For God's sake, somebody shoot her!"
"Can't," Steve said. "No guns up here but the kids, and that one's empty."
"Ralph, get downstairs with David," Johnny said. He started carefully down the hall. "Get down before..."
But the thing which had been Audrey Wyler had no further interest in David, it seemed. It reached the arched entrance to the balcony, then crawled through it. Almost at once, the support timbers, dried out by the desert climate and dined upon by generations of termites, began to groan. Steve hurried after Johnny, his arms still around Cynthia. Ralph came toward them from the other end of the hall. They met just in time to see the thing in the soaked dress reach the balcony railing. Audrey had crawled over the mostly deflated sex doll, leaving a broad streak of blood and less identifiable fluids across its plastic midsection. Frida's pursed mouth might have been expressing outrage at such treatment. What remained of Audrey Wyler was still clutching the railing, still attempting to pull itself up enough to dive over the side, when the supports let go and the balcony tore away from the wall with a large, dusty roar. At first it slipped outward on a level, like a tray or a floating platform, tearing away boards from the edge of the hallway and forcing Steve and the others back as the old carpet first tore open and then gaped like a seismic fault. Laths snapped. Nails squealed as they divorced the boards to which they had been wedded. Then, at last, the balcony began to tilt. Audrey tumbled over the side. For just a moment, Steve saw her feet sticking out of the dust, and then she was gone. A moment later, and the balcony was gone, too, falling like a stone and hitting the seats below with a tremendous crash. Dust boiled up in a miniature mushroom cloud.
"David!" Steve shouted. "What about David? Is he alive?"
"I don't know," Ralph said. He looked at them with dazed and teary eyes. "I'm sure he was when I brought him out of the projection booth, but now I don't know. I can't feel him breathing at all."
3.
All the doors leading into the auditorium had been chalked open, and the lobby was hazed with dust from the fallen balcony. They carried David over to one of the street doors, where a draft from the outside pushed the worst of the drifting dust away. "Put him down," Cynthia said. She was trying to think what to do next, hell, what to do first, but her thoughts kept junking up on her. "And lay him straight. Let's turn his airways into freeways." Ralph looked at her hopefully as he and Steve lowered David to the threadbare carpet. "Do you know anything about this?"
"Depends on what you mean," she said. "Some first aid, including artificial respiration, from when I was back at Daughters and Sisters, yeah. But if you're asking if I know anything about ladies who turn into homicidal maniacs and then decay, no."
"He's all I got, miss," Ralph said. "All that's left of my family." Cynthia closed her eyes and bent toward David. What she felt relieved her enormously, the faint but clear touch of breath on her face.
"He's alive. I can feel him breathing."
She looked up at Ralph and smiled. "I'm not surprised you couldn't. Your face is swelled up like an inner tube."
"Yeah, maybe that was it. But mostly I was just so afraid."
He tried to smile back at her and failed. He let out a gusty sigh and groped backward to lean against the boarded-over candy counter.
"I'm going to help him now," Cynthia said. She looked down at the boy's pale face and closed eyes. "I'm just going to help you along, David. Speed things up. Let me help you, okay? Let me help you."
She turned his head gently to one side, wincing at the finger marks on his neck. In the auditorium, a hanging piece of the balcony gave up the ghost and fell with a crash. The others looked that way, but Cynthia's concentration remained on David. She used the fingers of her left hand to open his mouth, leaned forward, and gently pinched his nostrils shut with her right hand. Then she put her mouth on his and exhaled. His chest